Welcome to the Packet Pushers, a technical podcast about data networking that's published several times per month. Packet Pushers is a unique and nerdy deep dive on technical and engineering matters in the world of networking, a space where we tackle technical topics about the industry, talk vendors and networking technology. We don't apologize for being willfully and deliberately technical. We're willing to ask complex questions, to discuss marketing, and generally make fun of just about anybody we get a chance to do that to. I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or I was on Twitter as @etherealmind. And as always, I'm joined by my trusty sidekick and generally the brains and nice guy of the operation, Mr. Ethan Banks.
To Greg's bad cop, I am decidedly the good cop. I am his handler, and I'm not doing a very good job of that. Yes, we're at the end of the Network Field Day 5 event in San Jose, where I am crashing to earth like a plane with no wings. I am exhausted. It's been a good week, but we have had a nonstop plethora of vendor presentations where they have showed us, well, I'd say the theme was SDN, for sure.
Session. We've had three or four vendor presentations based around the SDN visions, of course, which puts me right in my little happy spot.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, me too. Well, that's where all the interesting things are happening. You know what I'm saying?
It is. Yeah. It's not like there's a whole bunch of fun happening around OSPF extensions this year, is it?
So, well, no. And although our listeners might be saying, yes, but OSPF is what I use every day. I would love some extensions. That would be really interesting. The fact of the matter is the world's heading in a somewhat different direction because the problems are being solved in new and different ways with a lot of compute power in x86 being brought to bear.
Yeah, definitely. So what we've done is we've brought along some new brains this week. I'd like to welcome Dr. Pete Welcher. How are you, Pete?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, although I'll agree that it's been a long 4 days and the brain's starting to fade a little bit.
Okay. And so why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a longtime CCIE. I'm doing network architecture, network design stuff, and then I hand off to our implementation team. We're in the consulting space, Chesapeake Net Craftsman. I've authored a bunch of Cisco classes. Terry Slattery brought me in as a part-time and then full-time employee way back in 94, where the Skunk Works did the iOS CLI.
Yep.
I can tell you where all the bodies are buried inside that CLI. It's a top-down, bottom-up parser.
Right, yep.
It's not a yackable grammar. That's probably more than you wanted to know.
That's probably way more than I... No, just give me a software layer. I'm all SDN these days, isn't it? Mm-hmm. CLI is taking a bit of a hit. Now, did you enjoy being here?
I've enjoyed being here. It's been an eye-opener. I've been reading about SDN for a while, and it's been refusing to gel. And I think it's starting to gel, although an amazing amount of detail this week.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll talk about that maybe and maybe expand, maybe see if we can find some more wisdom in amongst the things. And also joining us is Brent Salisbury. Brent, what's happening with you, brother?
Oh, I am just I think I'm right behind Ethan without a parachute crashing. So,
yeah, in your case, that's because you're up till 2 o'clock in the morning drinking with vendors, right?
No, of course not. It's writing code now. So. It was a really fun week. I think to your point, there's a lot of SDN. I'm kind of happy about that because I'm going to have to find a job plumbing if SDN doesn't work out.
I think after this week, you can work out that SDN is going to be – there's an awful lot of smoke at least.
Yeah, kind of to that point, I would say when I saw the NFV document come out, Network Function Virtualization, which all the carriers got together and put out about – almost 5 months ago, that was kind of the tipping point for me. When AT&T, who spends as much as they do every year, says they want this, I think they're going to get it.
And not only AT&T, it's been right across Europe as well. So the American carriers want this NFV thing, and so does the European carriers as well. They see it as a way to move forward. So I think what we did to the organization of today's show is we've just picked at random. We've sat through nearly 20 hours of presentations, I think, over the last 3 days. And I thought what we'd do is touch on each of the vendors and maybe grab on to a couple of topics that we all thought were actually moderately interesting. So I thought I'd start on a rant when Cisco showed us the CAT 6500 with their quad soup strategy. Anybody care? Anybody?
Yeah, I did a finger twiddle there for those who couldn't hear that. I realize that doesn't translate well through the microphone.
I mean, the quad soup strategy that they showed us was a VSS pair with two soups in each member of the VSS pair, and being able to do stateful failover between any of those soups. Everybody's in hot mode, hot standby modes, that stateful switchover, SSO. So losing any one of the supervisor engines is hitless. You don't really feel that sting. So it's expensive to do that, for sure. But it for very high availability environments, they're targeting that. So do we care?
Presumably those very high availability environments care. The pitch used to be if you do the VSS, you only need one soup in each of the two chassis, so you can cut your costs.
Yeah, the idea being you plumb up to both VSS chassis, you can lose any one. And yes, you've lost half your forwarding capacity, but you dual wired everything and planned for that, so that's okay. Mm-hmm. Now it's nothing can go down ever, so we're going to have you four soups active.
But ultimately, still only 80 gigabits per second, right? So each line card can still only do 40 gigabits per second. So if you dual active the crossbar fabrics in the back of the supervisors, then it's 80 gigabits per second. So now that's Cisco marketing magic. So the real number there is with both fabrics running, that's actually only 40 gigabits.
Well, the thing that surprised me about that is I've been a real fan of the Nexus platform, because I just see the 6500 kind of being incremental here and capacity limited. They've had a recent repositioning, which might be a cynical person might dub full-time job security for the 6500 programmers. I've sort of wondered for a while why MPL didn't make it into some of the smaller platforms, and I think that might have been protecting market share for the 6500.
But the 6500 runs the same code as the 4500 platform, so they both run iOS XE now. So it's not like there's feature parity between the two. In although the underlying code is parity, the feature parity in the 6500 is a little different. I mean, the Cat 4500 does 48 gigabits per second per slot.
So people are starting to look at that and VSS on that. It's particularly attractive for closets or smaller data centers where the throughput isn't as big a concern. I kind of like it for the closets. I'm kind of hoping for something that sort of works like the fabric extender, where you could have a pair of big switches that are the core of the building, and then all the closet switches become FEX, multi-module FEX.
I believe that is coming for the 6500. I believe that was announced. That and FabricPath and some of the other big boy data center technologies making down the 6500.
It just seems so...
At some point, Pete kind of touched on the competing BUs. At some point, you just have to kill the data center people or kill it. What's stopping people from using a 5K?
Cisco says it's 40 gigabits per second per slot, but the way their marketing calculates it is 20 gigs in and 20 gigs out. Right, so that you add them together and you get 40. So really the only...
Marketing math has always puzzled me. So now the positioning is that you want a 4500 or 6500 for the campus features and the Nexus. And actually I do see a little bit of wisdom into that. What I'm thinking is history here, the 7600. Mm-hmm. The programming teams got overwhelmed between the 6500 and the 7600, or at least that's what I sort of heard through the back door. And so it may be rational, if you have a rapid pace of change in the Nexus world, to try to focus the features and not be all things to all people.
Yeah.
So there is a position for the 6500 still, though, and I think that's why it soldiers on. You know, number one, you've got Cisco customers with huge numbers of Cisco 6500 chassis that are out there and installed. They don't want to have to do a rip and replace with a brand new chassis. They can keep throwing supervisor engines at it. They can keep throwing upgraded line cards at
it. Keep something that's nominally CLI parity.
Yeah.
Well, and what are you going to go to? I think there's a huge missing market. When are you going to put a 7K in your building distribution for high availability? Or if you need 10 gig?
Well, that's what they were telling me, too.
Oh, well, right. And 3 years ago, the 7K was not the 6K replacement.
No. But 2 years ago, it was.
What
I've been able to do in a couple of building designs is use VDCs. So you have a pair of 7Ks that are both core and distribution layer. Mm-hmm. And one of the debates is, do you actually need to separate those two layers, or why not just merge them?
Collapse the core. Absolutely. I will say, and I'm kind of curious on your guys' take. One the reason I've kind of it's a VSS. We've got some really high availability hospital type locations, and you've got this one logical instance. If the logical instance goes down, so do both of them, right? So do I want to deal with convergence and have two separate things to where if somebody does maintenance on one, he's not destroying both the pair. So
I like that aspect of the Nexus and doing VPC is it's separate entities. Right now, right. The challenge there is the routing behavior where VPC really, you don't want to do routing over a VPC port channel.
Yeah, the hashing gets a little weird there.
Well, you get people are telling me that the Pure Gateway command fixes that, but it's not a supported solution according to everything. I periodically check that particular one.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Because I even have Cisco SEs telling me, oh, yeah, it's no longer a problem, and it's not clear that that's correct.
What's that magic feature? Pure Gateway.
There's a command. I'm thinking it's Pure Gateway at the minute. It was put in for certain NetApp storage devices, NetApps and EMCs, that learn where the receiving device learns the source MAC.
That's right.
Rather than the default gateway's MAC and replies.
Yeah.
And it locks it. It doesn't let it go.
Right.
Yeah. So if the gateway goes down, it doesn't fail over to the...
And so depending on your hashing, the problem was that it would go up the wrong member of the VPC port channel, go across the peer link, and then it couldn't be forwarded out another VPC port channel.
Right.
Mm. So, but aside from that, I think the quad soup in the 6500 is a great idea. Not.
Well, if you have surplus budget, it's great for removing that problem.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been saying you've been flogging a dead horse for the better part on 6500 for a while, and I guess you can flog it harder than you ever could before.
If I can, one product that I was and am pretty excited about is the 3850 switch and the new wireless approach.
Okay.
I'd caught part of that puzzle because I'd been wondering for a couple of years about why don't I have much bigger pipes between the wireless controller and the network? Because if you do the math on, say, 500 access points doing 802.11n, there's a huge bottleneck there.
Yep. Yep.
Now, the piece I'd missed apparently was the other bottleneck is the constraint of the CAPWAP tunneling.
Mm-hmm.
So they've now done that in hardware, and by distributing across switches, they're getting into a good position to do the next generation 802.11a.
Mm-hmm. So you've got a bunch of Brent. You've got a whole bunch of Wi-Fi's. What do you think?
From a centralized management point, wireless is what the future of campus networks should look like. Somebody goes out to the wiring closet, slams in a switch, it dials home, an operator configures it. Like done. So what drives me nuts about that product is that's not being talked about, right? This is just, we can distribute to the edge because I've got so much east-west campus between my wireless points at the edge, right? So distributing the forwarding there is one thing. And then the other, for a lot of huge large campuses, fiber isn't the problem to go back to a centralized point. So I've got all connectivity back to that central point isn't a problem. So now where I can centralize everything in one spot, I can always make sure that I'm at maximum subscription to it. So when I get to 80, 90% there, then I add another and scale out horizontally.
So what you're saying is if you start putting a controller in every floor of every building,
right?
How are you going to manage all those controllers?
Well, and so I assume there is. It looks like that'll plug in NCS. But if I'm putting the same capacity on every floor, one floor I might have 200 APs. The other floor I might have 2. So now I've got capacity at 2 or 3% on one of those. What I am excited about with the 3850 is they're putting, CPUs, SOCs, whatever it is, we're getting some more hardware into the edge. What I want to do with that is run systems on it, embedded systems. Mm-hmm. So
it was a little shocking that you couldn't cascade an older 3750 into the 3850, at least to me. I hadn't caught that before. The concern there would be exactly what you said about the low density, because suppose I have a building where I don't have very many APs. Maybe there's a lot of storage or who knows what. And so I at least conceptually, only need one 3850 for the entire building, and I want to daisy chain some other switches off of it, or at least star them off of it to put the APs on and do the PoE thing. Can't do that.
Mm-hmm. No, and that is a brand new StackWise interface that's on there. It's a StackWise 480, and these are plug-in compatible things. So if you're used to the stackables that have been around for a very long time, that big ugly silver cable that you'd screw into the back, what kind of looked like an old school SCSI connector, and now it's a whole completely different connector and completely different capacity across the backplane. So you cannot plug in a 3850 to a 3750 stack.
So you're calling their cable SCSI.
Yes, yes, apparently I am.
Because it looks like one.
No. That was scuzzy, though, not sleazy.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you for making the distinction.
And I think a really interesting point, though, with having this, and I'll circle back to it really quick, is so every box is going to ship with this extra hardware in it. You'll unlock it with a licensing, some kind of licensing feature, I presume. But this is kind of the start of life cycling control mechanisms separately from forwarding and data plane mechanisms. Does that make sense? So as you add more APs or you need something that's forwarded or that needs state somewhere, you're now just unlocking something with a license instead of going out buying a brand new something to route it or something to centralize it.
So it comes back. This is where Cisco – I think we're going to see Cisco – more and more emphasize their hardware capabilities because it is a competitive differentiator between them and the, you know, we're going to, I think in a few minutes we'll start talking about SDN because just about all the rest of the event was SDN. But Cisco's competitive edge is that they do make good hardware. They make good boxes. They don't break or fail much. Mm-hmm. No matter how hard you look at Cisco, at the end of the day, the hardware is well made. You know, there's metalwork and power supplies and stuff inside them. I might whinge and bitch about the software reliability and the upgradability, but
yeah, you might occasionally get a bad manufacturing run, let's say, something like that. These things happen, but that's fair to say that by and large, Cisco has grabbed as much market share as it has, in part because the hardware, when you plug it in, it's bulletproof.
I have a customer that just turned off a somewhat aging 7500, and they looked at it, and I think the story was that they looked at the code version and realized that thing's been running for 7 years. We never turned it off. Mm-hmm. We never upgraded the code. We probably should have.
Yeah.
Oh, it's. I'm not sure whether to be embarrassed when I find something that has the 660 days of uptime, whatever the max is, and won't go anymore or not. But I think that's an interesting point, that meantime between failure has gotten so much better that it's like, oh, if it works, we don't necessarily need to lifecycle it, right?
Yeah.
I just think we're going to see more of that. Cisco's going to emphasize their hardware capabilities because it is a market differentiator. And, you know, we've talked about the merchant silicon thing in the past.
And they can still get away with that for now because there's a lot of shops that aren't really thinking about the new SDM paradigm that I assume we're getting into now. People are still thinking in terms of a router is a router, and this there's a firewall appliance, and this is a switch, and I buy this thing in a box, and I put it in my rack, and I when I need it to go faster, I buy a new one.
Well, there's an interesting thought there that just hit me. I hope it's interesting. They've been pushing the idea of putting the UCSE into the ISRG2 chassis, and you think of it as a router with a strap-on server. At what point does that flip where you're running the router as a virtual machine on server software in a Cisco-flavored box, in effect, that also serves other functions, load balancer being a conspicuous gap right now in the product line.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about CSR before we started. Let's say you don't start dropping physical software routers on something strapped to the back of it.
Well, that's another thought is if you're thinking maintaining code, if you have a common code tree for the ASR1K and the CSR, more or less, do you plunk that in and have variable CPUs processing that in your other boxes so you don't have to support multiple code trains that are tied to a specific platform hardware?
That's exactly what happened. So the CSR is the same iOS XE code train that comes out of the ASR1000, which comes from the same team that makes the 4500 hardware.
Now, it's got some distinctive changes because they had to strip out all the ties into the hardware layer.
So the CSR is a one cut down. So if you look at the software architecture, it's exactly the same. It just doesn't have any of the silicon acceleration. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to remember. I think the ASR1K is like good for 5 gigabits per second or something last time I checked. And the CSR is good for 5 to 1 gigabit per second plasma rifled into 40 watt range.
Well, the initial comment at Networkers last year was that it was priced like an ASR1K with the performance of an ISRG2.
Yeah.
It's kind of backwards.
They've taken off the arbitrary limits in the CSR and let it run up.
And the conjecture was that it was going to be discounted heavily to cloud providers, and marketing people generally want to set the price high because you can always come down, but you can't go up.
Yeah, so with its previous pricing, I wasn't going to buy it. I would have gone and bought something else. Mm-hmm. With its current pricing model, I'm looking at this anyway at the moment. We'll talk more about it. So let's jump over to the topics that perhaps is a bit more interesting. And what I want to do is point out that we had four vendors talking to us about SDN. Cisco, Brocade, Juniper talked about their Contrail SDN acquisition, and we also had Plexi, who is more SDN than forwarding, but Why don't we? Which one do you want to kick it off with?
Let's talk about Plexi. They're the oddball in this mix, I think, because what Plexi is offering is a switch, an Ethernet switch. Not exciting. Everybody knows what an Ethernet switch is. That has got for interconnection, rather than doing a traditional. Let's say you got 48 10 gig ports on the front, or 32 or whatever, and then you uplink with several different 40 gig links. They are interconnecting their switches in a ring topology, and across that ring, they've got one going to the left and one piece of fiber going to the right, and then they break out into waves. So then they take a piece of software, and with their software, they analyze the traffic that's going around their network, around the Plexi ring, and analyze to see who is talking to who. Then they can. This is a little bit hard to do without a whiteboard, but the magic here of the waves going around the ring is that they can make one switch talk to directly to any other switch, and logically it is hopless.
Yeah, it's not a single ring; it's a channelized ring.
That's so right.
You've got 24 10 gigs coming out of a single switch, and you can terminate those 10 gig channels on any other switch.
And to a point, you can go to 5 to the left and 5 to the right, I believe 11 Plexi switches in a ring allow for full meshing between each of the switches that are there, with 40 gig going in one direction to the switch on the one side, 40 to the one on the right, and then 20 to all the others as you increment in the hop.
That's around the ring. So I think of it as a logical full mesh using the waves, and then you can sort of in software repatch the connections. Might be another way to think about it. So it's a really new approach to it, and there's a lot to wrap your brain around. Is this advantageous to me? How can I leverage it? The part that rode on top of that was this notion they had of affinity groups. So you let the controller cook, it looks at the traffic, and then you can start picking up on traffic patterns, moving links in effect, rearranging the optics, or you can try to ensure kid glove treatment, special treatment for traffic that is picky.
They gave us examples of traffic that was latency sensitive. I want this to be minimized for hop count, let's say, because latency is very important to me.
Isolation was the other example.
So the concern, no other traffic rides on this particular link, so isolating the traffic in that way.
Right. What I was hearing as a incomplete piece at best was the awareness of applications. It seemed like it could report on who's talking to whom a lot, and then you have to specify the policy, and right now that looked like it was there, but a little bit primitive. The other notion that they had was that the controller did a fit, so it kind of looked at the traffic, and through a fit.
I was far more interested in the software, because what they can do is they can, because they have they've developed an application to look at what traffic's talking to what, so that you know which ones you want to put together. So if you want to know where you want to terminate your channels, you need to know what traffic needs to talk to what. So if you have two servers in your data center, and one's a SQL and one's a web app, you might want to plumb those two together. But as a networking guy, we don't know whether that application's burning a lot of bandwidth or whether it's just the server guy making noise.
Right, and so the sticky thing that I've seen is when you try to do so-called app mapping for application performance management, there are applications that do this, they're hideously expensive. All the feedback I've gotten to date is that it's very labor intense, because you need somebody to get out the thumb screws and extract from the application guys which servers serve up their application. You know, what was the name of that database server? And then you have to locate the topology. Some of that's been done for you with this affinity.
Yeah, they kind of – what I thought – I was trying to think of how to describe it. But if you can imagine, they don't use NetFlow or S-Flow at all.
No.
But if you imagine taking S-Flow from every switch in your data center and then being able to map all the flows and then show you where the data load is.
Actually, I was talking to Derek last night about this, and they do use S-Flow.
Right.
So that is one piece of how they're putting the puzzle together. Another piece is they can pull input from different devices that are out there. So they can talk to VMware and figure out host names, for example. So it's not strictly, I only know IP addresses because that's what I see on the wire. It can also be informed by applications that are outside their controller that they can communicate with, and then have a more intelligent understanding that is more more human understandable, mm-hmm. and then help folks to make a decision about how they're going to do Infinity.
Right. So we did get the explicit assumption stated, I believe, that the application developers kind of know what's going on, and I'm not sure that's borne out by empirical evidence in what I've seen.
They think they do. Servers, yeah.
Well,
I know what application developers know of the network, that bandwidth is infinite, there's zero latency.
There you go.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Those types of questions.
So the other piece that I caught on to was this fit mechanism where you do a fit and then you sort of impose a topology change on the Plexi network. And it struck me as kind of going back to some of the FrameRay ATM WAN technology where you would model your traffic flows centrally and then push out routing instructions to your FrameRay switches, your ATM switches.
Yep.
And it struck me as, and I didn't hear anything to the contrary having probed, it sounded like a little bit of a static mechanism that they're going to program topologies and they're going to cover the contingency of if any switch fails, here's your alternative topology for 500.
So they have a primary and a redundant
large number
path.
Of failures.
That's right. Yeah.
So you don't have to depend on the controller. Not having to depend on the controller is good, but the fact that they had to pre-program that is a little bit scary because it's not a dynamic system, I guess.
You didn't have to pre-program it. I think I know that they made the point that you can run a Plexi ring with no controller whatsoever involved.
Right.
They'll come up out of the box. They can they can forward to each other, fine, and that the controller begins the process of traffic analysis and then optimizing the traffic.
Mm-hmm. So the concern was if you have kid glove treatment going to some particular type of traffic and there's a problem of failure.
Right.
What I heard was, well, that'll just kind of revert to default mode if there's no alternative pre-coded in. But if I went to the bother of giving it kid glove treatment, is my customer going to be happy if it's all of a sudden just in there with the...
Because I had some kind of a link go down or something like that.
I imagine that's a customer thing. People would be asking what happens if the controller goes away, and they're saying you've got the option to put redundant paths in so you don't need the controller if you lose the
right. So I'm not necessarily slamming it. I'm just kind of saying it's something I'd like to understand a little bit more fully and what the implications are.
So the SDN component there is the affinity, the fact that they get all the data back out of the network, mm-hmm. they analyze it, they can show you what the live, like the hotspots in the network, what the traffic flows look like, and then you can make topology decisions with actual data instead of just what we usually do, which is guess.
Sorry. The other random idea I had there was it's sort of adjusting the cabling to fit the application. And what I kept finding through all these sessions was maybe you go the other way. I think I heard that Alcatel-Lucent has a product that does affinity in the sense of moving VMs so they're together physically on the same switch. And so it's kind of everything I'm hearing sounds like let's run tunnels, let's do something to do plumbing. And what I'm not hearing is maybe we should move the VM instead of doing plumbing.
I haven't heard that.
I haven't heard that about Alcatel-Lucent specifically, but as an intellectual exercise, it makes sense.
VM was one of those A companies.
Yeah.
It could might be. I haven't heard too much in that sort of space. I don't think there's too much emphasis on that for example, I'm working in a cloud network, and my ability to move VMs to a specific location by affinity is actually it's extraordinarily difficult because you have to make sure the available VM, the VMs or the pool or the rack has the resources, and then you have to, you know, that's hard. And in today, we don't have the mental capacity in the hypervisor management platforms.
The last point I wanted to make about Plexi, because we should probably wrap that up and move on to some of the other interesting stuff, was you can scale it up big, and you don't have to scale it all in one ring. And they said they have no known limit to how big you can make a single Plexi ring, but they said most customers aren't really doing it that way. I think they've tested the algorithm up to 250 switches. That rings a bell. But that practically speaking, most customers are doing stacked rings. They make one Plexi ring and stack another one and then stack another one.
25 racks is a lot of gear. Right.
Yeah.
I think Plexi's got an interesting solution. I want to keep moving on.
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to touch very quickly on Brocade because we had a great presentation there. There was two of them. One was Viata, who very quickly, for those of you who don't know, I'm big on software routing, the idea of having routers in software on bog standard Intel x86 architectures in hypervisors. I thought that Brocade might have done more with the Viata acquisition by now, but clearly they're still digesting the acquisition. They said,
"Well, it's only been a couple of months at this point, right? It's been
how long does it take? You can change software overnight, can't you?"
No, I mean it was clear talking to them that the you know there hadn't been much integration done yet. The CEO at Brocade is still new,
yeah,
and so clearly there's a path there of what they're going to do with Viata because they can take rich router functionality, firewall kind of services, and put it out at the edge. Put it up on the software.
So they're coming with that, and that is seems to bind in nicely. So we had a long discussion about their SDN strategy, which is very open flow centric. And that's different from all the other vendors. They're the only people pushing the open flow boat into the middle of the stream.
So on the Viata topic a little bit, at the very end, I really recommend Chad Myers for folks to watch the end of that at the very least. But he kind of alluded to, you know, he ran out of time, but he alluded to, well, here's Viata and here's our operating system. Yeah. How do these merge? And I think the driver there would be you've got things like OpenVSwitch that are out there that theoretically can serve it, at the very least a forwarding target or at least a nice open source switch, which about every vendor is using for the for that matter.
That's right. Yeah.
So he alluded to kind of collapsing that together. So now, you know, this idea of having this a control plane and a data plane in one open source package, that felt like what he was kind of getting at with that.
Yeah.
Mm. But Brocade's big on OpenFlow. They see Quantum, OpenStack, you know, OpenStack talking to Quantum using OpenFlow to configure forwarding paths right. in the network.
So, I mean, when it comes to Brocade and OpenFlow, I don't know of anybody better than them out there. Every time, I mean, 6 months ago, we had a presentation from them, and they just destroyed it. They truly believe in kind of the three tenets, you know, if you go by the founders, you know, whether it's Casado, Shanker, McCune, you know, it's decoupled control plane, a separate network operating system, you can call that a controller, and then also, you know, agnostic forwarding protocol, wire protocol. How do we get from network operating system and talk to yep. underlying switch? That's the threat, mm-hmm. the third leg. I mean, a lot of people are talking about their SDN solutions, but without that agnostic instruction set,
yep.
it never really happened.
Yeah, but Brocade took their presentation about SDN one step further because they showed us what's happening globally on was this context? Was Internet 2?
Internet 2's layer 2 network globally, nationally especially, is on 100 gig MLXs. And I mean, just go out and price MLX 100 gig ports to Cisco and Juniper. Yeah. It's just a price thing. You might not have – you don't have forwarding tables like you would on an MX or, you know, a 9K, ASR 9K, but – 100 gig at the cost of the, you know, it's really expensive. So I think that brings in data path cost versus control plane cost. I mean, we're going to start seeing these life cycles.
Did they show us 6 continents or 7?
Yeah.
I don't think I saw Antarctica.
No, that was about the only one they didn't. But then David Meyer, who's their chief science officer or chief technical, I'm not
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, CTO in there.
I think he rode in on a unicorn. That's all I remember.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then proceeded
blew
to
our
give
brains
us. Up. Yeah. Okay, so I'm not really going to talk a lot about what he talked about, except to recommend go and watch it because it just, what he was talking about was the fact that networking systems are robust yet fragile. So we need to be able to design the next generation of controller-based networks and the protocols that we develop need to be able to survive a different model. Up until now, we've had this, you know, TCP/IP, we drop a bomb on one part and the network will all root around it and it'll all continue to work. In reality, we're probably moving away from that in the internet. You know, this use of tunnels and BGP, you know, the fact that all the major pops are in single point of failure locations like Las Vegas and San Francisco where there's like earthquakes.
So do you gamble with your packets in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
Or do they just check
right.
in and stays yeah. in Vegas?
They're all anti-gambling. Didn't you know yeah. that? Yeah, there's no gambling on the internet. If yeah. you ask the American government, no gambling on the internet at all. Yeah.
One takeaway that I had was that, to paraphrase it, the pace of change is picking up.
Hmm.
And I'm sort of starting to see some of what, you know, if I had to recapitulate what I heard, it's that we we have vendors that are still pushing hardware. We have vendors that are trying to figure out how to do SDN and somehow bring hardware into the picture. Mm. And then we have other vendors that are starting to think about everything's totally virtual. Forget about the hardware. Yep. Or there's some hardware there, but it's pretty dirt simple. And I'm seeing this as waves that are piling up on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And some vendors and possibly some customers are going to buy into something that's sort of obsolete before you get it installed.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there was a larger point that I took away from it, which was all of the complexity that we put into the networks to make them more robust ends up making them, after a point, more fragile. Mm-hmm. And his whole mindset was, and how do we get away from that? And then he began, after giving that 10,000-foot view, he began to get into some of the specifics about how SDN could maybe get us to a point where we can have a very robust network that is yet simple to operate and robust in its underlying protocols as well. So we were actually hoping to get David on to do the full presentation because he got cut short at Brocade. There just wasn't enough time, and he had a lot to talk about, and some of his ideas weren't even 100% fully formed.
Yeah.
We found out afterwards. So this is something he's been working on for quite a while. We're hoping we can get him on the podcast to talk through it because it was really interesting. Mm-hmm. Quite an interesting thing.
He seemed to be talking about learning occurring sort of in nature, and maybe there's something like that. And I found myself thinking about that a little bit this morning when we were talking about Puppet, because if you start doing particular, if you're doing regression testing and treating the network topology and the network configuration as something that you deploy, like software, then maybe you can at least make sure you don't repeat mistakes of the past.
That's right. And I think that's a big thing, is that we are going to be modeling our networks in software a lot more. So we've seen the vendors. So, for example, we didn't get anything from Cisco about their Carriden acquisition, but Carriden is a company that has spent over a decade building network modeling software, especially around, you know, MPLS paths and being able to analyze them and look for path failures, what happens if this fails on this, and then alerting you about that so that you can make a decision. I think we'll see more of that in the months to come. Mm-hmm.
Before we go off Brocade, just real quick, I'd like to, you know, Kurt Bagman gave a quick update on the ONF. So he was giving us some information from the black box. But to Kurt's credit, I mean, he's out there talking to any of us and, you know, little people like me and saying, here's how I can help you with what you're doing, you know, the OpenFlow network that you're building out. Definitely want to give a shout out to Kurt for helping.
Yeah, Kurt, cool. He was only up there for 10 minutes, but he gave us, like you said, an update of what's going on in the black box, because the Open Networking Foundation isn't. It's really a closed shop. You got to pay a significant fee, $30,000, to be a member, which entitles you to engage in the conversation. If you're not a member, then you can't – there's not even an archive mailing list, which we floated as an idea. Couldn't – even if we can't participate, could we at least see the mailing list if we wanted to kind of understand the thought process that's going on? And he said, I don't think any of us have ever thought of that. Yeah. You know, in theory, that wouldn't be harmful.
Put a 3-month lag or a 2-month lag on the, you know, put a 30-day lag on the mailing list and then make it read only so we can read it. But
something. Just, you know, yeah. But if that's important to you, you're interested in knowing on what's going on in the ONF proceedings. He said it's not unreasonable to, as a parody, call them the Closed Networking Foundation and try to make the point that they are a black box.
That's right, the Closed Open Network Foundation.
Right. Yeah. So. Poke them with a stick, maybe, politely, and maybe we can get some groundswell attraction out there and get a little more insight into what's going on. I mean, it's to be fair, they're not the IETF, and they're not the IEEE, and they have a different charter and a different set of goals, and they're trying to rapidly develop this protocol. So they don't want a lot of outside interference and things getting cluttered up.
And it was by design. It was to get this agile standards body, but we're a couple specs down the road now. It's now time to start getting people to look at adoption if they're to hope this happens. And so it's time to bring in, open the tent a little bit and make that happen.
And that's the problem with OpenFlow, is the potential is that other people will move around it. If the vendors don't feel that they're part of it, or if they can't, you know, put their problems into the mix and get them solved, they're going to avoid OpenFlow. Just like the IETF, anybody can create a protocol on the IETF and get it into the – I mean, I was
forces.
Reading
– Hey? Forces.
Forces, yeah, FORCES. If you've ever looked at the Forces standard, which looks a hell of a lot like OpenFlow, right? But it's been there for over 10 years, 7 years, I think, the standards have been rolling out the door, and no one ever stood up to salute it.
Because they took too long.
They took too long, but the vendors didn't want to participate. Mm. If you can't get them to participate, they're part of the industry. You know, they're the ones who actually have to commit serious cash to supporting protocols and stuff like that. So the OpenFlow, you know, needs to stand up and move, although a lot of OpenFlow relies on OpenStack and the Quantum module in terms of programming networking with that. So it'll be interesting to see. So I guess I want to come back to Cisco then and talk about there, where we had a two-hour free-flowing discussion with Cisco around their 1PK and their SDN strategy. And have written a couple of blog posts later, Peter, about 1PK. Did you feel more enlightened, inspired?
Well, it sounds like it's going to be very comprehensive. One of the things that I really kind of like the idea of was they're going to eat their own dog food. They are apparently developing applications on top of the API, and what it buys them is the ability to have a separate code tree so they can write the code once and then have the application available across all their platforms. Yes, you have to test it on the platform, but it's going to be a much more rapid development cycle as opposed to checking out the code over here and bringing it in at the whim of the product manager. And they get out all out of sync temporarily and so on and so forth. But I noticed the thing that they didn't talk about, which is daylight.
Well, I think the first rule of daylight is that we don't talk about daylight. You know?
Isn't that an ironic name?
Yeah.
So is it closed daylight? Or
my understanding is if you're part of it, you're not even allowed to say you're part of it per the board. So yeah,
it sounds a bit like the Patriot Act. So for the listener, so two things. First of all, I'd like to welcome Stephen Foskett, who's joining us, who is also the convener of Field Day. How are you, sir?
Why, thank you. It's good to be here. I'm glad to be able to join, even only at the 11th hour.
That's your decision.
Yes. So, it's not actually 11 o'clock.
No. So daylight for the people at home it's a rumored, of course we don't actually know if it exists or not, and a rumored consortium of the vendors to move the OpenFlow SDN, probably more of an SDN consortium from what the rumors suggest, so that and it's HP, Cisco, Juniper, IBM, and NEC, I think, are all rumored to be participating.
And I think Big Switch was supposed to have joined that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're not allowed to talk about it, but it's meant to progress SDN controller standards as opposed to, say, more down on the networking stuff so that SDN controllers have a chance of interoperating or converging around. Because one of the things that we've learned in the last 3 days is that the SDN's going in different directions between different vendors. They're definitely pursuing different technology threads.
Right. So I have the feeling that there's going to be a big splash whenever it comes out, maybe next month. Mm-hmm. And they're going to make a statement, and presumably it's all open source. Mm-hmm. And we'll see after all that stuff to see where that goes.
I guess it has to be open source, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Especially if Big Switch is tied up in it. Because you said, if Big Switch is truly tied up in daylight, then that is different from one of the rumors I'd heard a while back, which was there's going to be a consortium of major vendors that are going to work on a controller standard for the point of opposing Big Switch and sort of taking their, because they've got a leadership position in the market right now. They've been very open about what they've done with the Floodlight controller and the Big Switch controller and really engaging people to show them northbound, southbound. This is how we do it. Look, we've got something that works. We've got partnerships that we've aligned in the industry, and let's go. Let's make this thing happen. And all the big vendors are lagging behind.
Yeah. So the word is that it's Java based. So it's obviously not going to be Floodlight. So that leaves one controller that's open source. So today it's already open source because they're building on top of an open source platform. So since it's not, they're not going to take. Obviously, Big Switch is Floodlight, since it could be looked at as a view to edge Big Switch out. So they'll take Beacon, which was written by David Erickson out of Stanford. This is all speculation, but there's not a whole lot of options there if it's not Floodlight and it's Java. So,
well, and they wanted Java so they could run on arbitrary platforms.
Modularity,
sort of that you might have hierarchy or some running locally, some running centrally.
It'll be Java because that's what Cisco, HP, IBM. Big Switch all use Java programmers to write all their code.
Do we have to worry about which version of Java and security flows?
It'll all be in Tomcat engines, right? So that'll be Java app servers that run it. And it's not a thing that we care about because it'll come prepackaged into a piece of software. And we won't the server engine and the Java code will be wrapped up in something, and we'll just get whatever the vendors poop out at us. But I believe the strategy behind Daylight is running code. So vendors will contribute code that will run in the same way that the OpenStack model, anybody can contribute to OpenStack. And if you want a feature in OpenStack, then go and write the code and it'll go in and everybody will have that feature. Right. And I think the idea behind Daylight is to say, well, let's build a baseline controller. Everybody's going to contribute some code, make it up and get it, and so that there's some sort of And you know, running code is what matters. We're not going to have an argument about we want, you know, blue packets and red headers and, you know, it's not going to be that sort of
thing. Well, and look at the compute market, right? Like, if I put up a Windows server without an application, it's not there because I want to play solitaire. So we really can't do anything with operating systems, just a base operating system, Linux, Windows, whatever you prefer. It really is no value without applications running on top of it. So I'm really impressed with the vendors to go out and say it's still shocked.
It's the only way forward, though, really. Right now, look how many controllers are out there. HP's got a controller. Juniper's announced a controller. There's the Big Switch controller. Cisco's got a controller. And everybody's doing it different. None of these are intercompatible pieces, and you're really tied into a vertical stack now. Your vendor lock-in becomes even more egregious than it has been in the past. So a standardized controller or some baseline of standard, I mean, obviously everyone's going to have their extensions. Everyone's going to have their modules that talk magic to their boxes. I would presume that. But a baseline, a common base of operations means we can all, third parties included, develop applications that can ride on a controller and talk to the hardware underneath. And that is a good thing. That maybe it's a little... A little less market differentiation at a point, but I think it helps the networking industry get back to what we're used to, which is a good bit of cooperation.
Gets beyond the basics where there's no point in having the competition and lets you focus on adding functionality.
Yeah. Right.
And sort of tames the chaos so that we can move on, like you said.
So networking's a bit different to other, you know, like Windows and Linux, there's zero interoperability, right, at the end of the day.
Yes.
Now, that seems to be acceptable, you know, or HPUCs or...
There's POSIX.
Yeah, so, which is a pretty nominal subset of functionality. So, but I think networking's always worked in a far more coherent, collaborative way, in that everybody gloms together and comes out with something that's approximately, there's a certain amount of feature. You know, Juniper's different from Cisco's, different from HP, and the differences still exist, but you can interoperate them perhaps in a reduced capacity. Maybe you lose a few features here or there, but you certainly can interoperate multi-vendors.
Did you say co-opetition?
I didn't, but you did.
Yeah.
So that works, right?
And I really think we should probably start thinking of it as the network operating system decoupled from the monolithic device of everything in a box to applications on an OS.
Yeah. So 1PK, Cisco's 1PK to me, while I can see the value of it, you know, Cisco's routers have hundreds of features that most customers never ever use. You know, like even today, if you're using the C3PL to configure the QoS or the CLI, that's still excruciating. And we really need to have software, external software, that makes it possible to get into those features in a better way than we have now. And we have to be able to do it end to end, right? It's no longer enough to configure one router for QoS and then forget three others in the path. You have to configure all of them coherently, and we can no longer be doing it at the CLI. So 1PK exposes all those features. You can create a Java applet which can go and add a static route into a chassis and then redistribute that into OSPF. You can go along and create an applet that calculates the end-to-end media net path and configures all the media net engines along all the routers in a network. You can even do crazy things like create a Java applet that runs inside the iOS. So 1PK has the ability to create a container that you can then load your own Java applet into, and it can use fire commands to the Java applet, and then it'll run them autonomously. You can do things like what we do with Tickle today. If that interface flaps, then shut the interface down, you know, and open this one up, or, you know, whatever it is. Reboot if there's more than X number of memory errors or whatever it is you want to do.
Well, and I think I've heard it said that 90% of the commands in iOS are nerd knobs.
Yeah.
So you don't really need them. And for years, I've had a slight gripe about the fact that the documentation stopped separating out the important stuff from the rest.
Yeah, you can spend a lot of time trolling through that documentation.
Yeah.
So, but the flip side of 1PK is that it's nothing. It's not. It's like being thrown a set of Britannia encyclopedias and say, "Here's what you need to learn to go and get a degree in something, you know, relevant."
There was something thematic that we kept getting from Cisco as they were presenting about 1PK that was a bit of a new message, I think. The first thing that we were hearing about 1PK was at Cisco Live in 2012, Cisco Live US. They talked a lot about, we're giving the customer tools to enable them to do X. We don't know what X is going to be. Here you go, customer. Here's a set of APIs and libraries, and we want you to go do whatever it is that you think you want to do. Off you go.
Here's some knives. Don't cut yourself, okay?
But the message that we were getting during Netfield Day 5 is that Cisco was using 1PK internally for rapid development of new features, as opposed to, well, iOS is going to be in whatever the cycle of development is before they release a new one with these new features, and the risks that are inherent in that. Instead, they're going to take 1PK and deliver functionality themselves internally using 1PK and bring those to market quickly and presumably with less risk, because it would be an isolated feature and function from the rest of the baseline operating system.
And so that's pretty exciting. I think that's the positive takeaway that we have to not get stuck on just thinking of 1PK as being sort of the command line, which I was doing a moment ago, because it's also exposing things like monitoring statistics, packet counts, error counts, and God knows what. And I think that there's some of the ties like the AppNav functionality that we hear about in the MediaNet, where they're starting to leverage that in a cross-platform way. It could be pretty interesting.
The flip side of that, if I want to be cynical, is that it's not anything to anybody, right? So if you want to attach, how do we as engineers go in and make use of that? Well, Mr. Engineer, it can be anything you want. What do you want? Well, I don't know what I want. I want what I want. You know.
Well, I see it as a documentation problem, that if you have this incredibly deep API that exposes a lot of the innards. Well, if they are challenged documenting exactly what the commands do right now, I've always been puzzled about QS enable, and then the documentation says enabled QS, yes, but what's it really doing under the hood?
Right.
I mean, now you've got these API calls, just listing them is probably problematic.
1PK would be possibly interesting to the 1%ers. If you're Amazon and you're rolling your own control plane, that might be nice. But other than that, I don't want to write to tens of thousands of distributed boxes. I want to write code to a controller. I want to push to one central place or a distributed federation of central places that then executes down to the primitive.
But they do have an ecosystem building around some of the video partners where they're putting hooks into the applications that leverage, I think it's the MediaNet capability, so that you can actually see the traffic as it crosses the network.
You know,
so you have identifiers, I believe.
Yeah. And well, to Pete's point, and this is, and I don't know, and this is just pure speculation, but so we've got the management planes. So we've kind of, we've got some forwarding instantiations, then we have this management piece that we have to do things like push QoS, and we have to get synchronous information back from the forwarding targets. So, you know, you've got OVSDB coming out of VMware, you've got OF control coming out of the ONS, or out of the ONF, and then the only other thing I can think is that this is possibly going to grow into something more, to your point. And here's your network operating system in one, here are your applications. If you want to run these really cool applications that aren't covered by whatever standard, you know, here's the value in byte application.
So if we go back to SolarWinds, for example, who were presenting as well, what we really need is a standard set of APIs that one similar to what 1PK is doing, but across all the vendors, so Juniper and HP, you know, and Brocade, we should have a standard API for the interface. You know, so if I want to configure an interface, put it in a VLAN, and set it to be, you know, auto, give it a name, maybe create the VLAN, delete the VLAN. Well, why have we not got an API that can do that on every
Isn't that what SNMP is supposed to be?
Well, no.
So Juniper, it sounded like Juniper had started down that path with the with a few function calls built into the, what was it, NetDev?
NetDev, yeah.
Yeah. But and they're looking to the community, and presumably internally they're going to be seeding more calls. So instead of just create a VLAN and configure a couple of things on an interface, it's going to become a richer command set.
Well, the great thing about Puppet is it exists today. So I don't have to wait for an API to arrive. They put a Puppet agent in, and then they can just get going. And as they said right at the end, somebody asked the question, Colin McNamara asked the question as to why is the Puppet page on the Google site not branded by Juniper, and he said, well, because we want everybody to adopt it. We don't want it to be Juniper's Puppet, we want it to be the industry's Puppet. So there's a chance there to do something that is universal.
And maybe being a little bit optimistic, maybe Juniper's trying to show some leadership in doing generic calls as this evolves.
See, I like leadership. I like that idea. Because one of the things we're not seeing is leadership in a lot of these things, because the vendors are holding back. They've got to bet $1 billion. You know, they've got to make $1 billion out of every decision they make, or they think they do.
So let me ask for some clarification on Puppet from maybe some of you that are more familiar with it than me. Now, I looked at the Puppet demo today, and I got it. I got what was going on, but I didn't understand all the details. Now, I looked at Puppet as an abstraction layer, kind of. You have a Puppet agent on your hardware that communicates up to the Puppet master. This is what I can do. These are the ways I want want you to tell me what's going on. And then you write a, it wasn't really a script exactly, I'm not sure how to describe it, but you send down a set of properties that you want that script to have, and then the agent kind of transcribes that into, okay, now I got to run these. In the case of Junos, it was XML.
You send down a manifest.
Right.
Yeah.
So in Linux, you a puppet manifest says, I'm going to configure my DNS setting to be this. I'm going to set my IP address to be this, install this software, and then you have a sub-manifest for installing MySQL. So if you're deploying a Linux MySQL engine, you create a manifest that defines all the configuration parameters. You don't define the script.
Right.
You don't define
it. And that there, was the thing
a, there's
that...
There's a thing on the box that knows how to take the manifest and says, this is my broad... Here's the intention. Turn that into magic.
So it was a list of facts where here's your
facts,
name,
right.
Here's your address. And I'm thinking of, is it Star Trek where make it so?
Yeah. But the agent in the chassis then takes that manifest. And so if you send that data to a Juniper EX, it does this. If you send it to an MX, it will do whatever it needs to do to understand those. It's up to you to write a manifest that says...
So it becomes incumbent on the vendor then to make the agent bright enough to be able, or you know, powerful enough to be able to do the translating.
Right.
You're not sending a script down. So and this is the thing that I in my mind, I kind of had a preconceived notion of what I thought Puppet was doing. I thought it was a fancy way to manage scripts, and it isn't. It isn't that at all. So it's this translation engine kind of. You've got this Puppet agent on the switch that is then taking your directives and translating them, like you said, magic. In the case of Junos, XML gets pushed down. Here's the switch configuration, and you could even do a dry run, test it ahead of time. This is what I'm going to do. Is this look good? Yeah, and then off you go. You can commit to it.
So what I heard that I thought was missing a little bit was the, can I feed it a static route? Can I feed it an OSPF configuration? So they have to do that, but maybe that could be done in a somewhat vendor-neutral way. It seems like the sort of thing that you, under the hood, you might have to translate it to much different CLI or 1PK calls or whatever.
That's right. But I think the valuable thing to realize about Puppet is it, and there's various configuration tools. There's other ones, Chef and a few others. But Puppet is a universally used tool for setting up Linux servers.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
Really, you actually want to use the same tool that you use to deploy automated deployment of Linux, but not just Linux, but the applications that run on them. It'll be the MySQL or the Java Tomcat engine.
Which speaks exactly to why the initial things that you can do with Puppet on a Juniper switch are things like VLAN configuration. You know, very basic rudimentary things that you may need to tweak on a physical interface so that this Linux server, VM, whatever you just spun up, can now communicate to the network.
Yeah. Seems long overdue, does it not?
Well, it's so rudimentary, but it's something that people can use immediately right now. And take some network provisioning out of the – it's no longer – it's a separate step. Now you can roll it all into one spin-up package.
Okay. So two things then. We were talking about Cisco. So we had a long – then we followed up with a long discussion, which was a one-on-one, which went backwards and forwards about Cisco and SDN. Rather than to elaborate on that, I'm going to recommend that you go and watch that. I'll try and drop a link into the show notes and go and watch that video because it's a fascinating discussion between all of the delegates. And there was a dozen of us in the room and people from Cisco who were putting their – and it was a very passionate discussion, shall we say.
It was borderline – wasn't quite yelling and throwing things, but, I mean, it was the Silicon Valley equivalent perhaps.
And it's a long video, let me tell you. It's almost 2 hours long. In fact, I think it's right on the dot about 2 hours long.
Yeah.
But it really is worth watching it. And so far, that's the most watched video from Networking Field Day, by the way. It has twice as many views as anything else.
Got tweeted a lot.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So, Cisco's got an SDN strategy, and I think it was pretty much encompassed in that two-hour video. Why don't you go and watch all of that?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it would be fair to say that Cisco's SDN strategy is not clear yet, but then on the flip side, in their defense, Cisco's a very big company. It's got many divisions, and developing that strategy might take more time than other people.
Well, clearly it will, and clearly they put a stake in the ground against OpenFlow.
So if they're going to wait on customer demand to drive everything, then is that leadership or is that – so there's no risk to that. So the longer they wait on that, then somebody else is going to come and start taking market share when they do.
But Cisco, I would imagine that if Cisco feels that that's the lesser evil. They can afford to hang back, wait for the market, and then drive the tank into the down that street and –
There may be things happening under the covers that are ready to go when they need them.
Right. And it's a totally mixed message. I mean, we're dealing with a paranoid schizophrenic because, you know, one day it's here's our controller and it supports OpenFlow. So that's on record since, what, 6 months ago?
Yes.
So they're developing controllers that support OpenFlow on their kits. And they're saying one PK contains OpenFlow. Yet in the next breath, it's
NCEMI and we don't know what they're doing because we're not allowed to say, but it appears to be a very big networking fabric with a controller.
Right.
So could this be that they, rather than doing crawl, walk, run, they wanted to have a big splash with something that's sexier than what everybody else is doing?
Well, I think, I mean, Omar said, we're going to give you everything.
We're going to give you whatever it is you want. Buggy whips.
Yep.
Bigger horses.
And they're not going to scare us off by saying two loaded guns either. Because they're going to have to support it in the middle of the night. So they better get the writing applications.
The comparison between Brocade and Cisco when it came to OpenFlow was startling, though. Whereas Brocade was saying, this is OpenFlow. This is where we're at. We're engaged in the Open Networking Foundation. And these are the challenges that we're running into. We're having difficulty mapping OpenFlow operations into silicon, for example. We're having trouble with a variety of things. And they just got right down into it. This is what we're doing, what we're at. We're committed to it. We believe this is the way forward, but it's tough. And what we're working on in OpenFlow 1.4 is how to make it map better to silicon because we know that's a challenge we got to overcome. And then you go over to Cisco, and where they're at is, well, we don't know about this OpenFlow thing yet because it's kind of scary, and there's, you know, some security stuff. Who know? Maybe there's a bigger attack surface there.
Don't forget that nobody's using it.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and the, you know that too. I mean, the message that we got from two really big and significant vendors with a lot of stake in this market, we're giving very different messages.
Yep.
Brocade's got nothing to lose, not a friggin' thing. Cisco's got a massive hardware business to protect, and I think they still internally seem to perceive OpenFlow as a threat.
And the size creates inertia. Brocade being smaller, they've decided to focus. They seem to have committed.
Yes.
They've chosen to I think Cisco's hanging back either because of internal convergence problems or, you know, more likely executive problems who might perceive that there's an underfunding.
To follow what we said earlier, software evolves quickly, management decisions evolve more slowly.
Yeah, that would summarize it. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is we went to Juniper this morning, and their SDN strategy was – well, astonishing. They acquired Contrail. Contrail has a controller which is using a virtual routing edge. So I'm going to give a go at trying to explain a verbal picture around Contrail. Anybody else want to volunteer?
That was a complicated.
Everybody at home started.
I tried with Plexi. I tried with Plexi and failed miserably. So, yeah. But you guys picked me up. So,
okay, so
go for it.
Good. I'm going to start at the edge, right? So I'm going to start where today we have the access layer being the top of the rack. In the Contrail model, the access layer of switching is actually inside the hypervisor of the VM or inside the on a bare metal server. And they have a custom piece of software, which is a virtual router, which goes into the hypervisor and the VMs attached to it. Now, each of those switches, those virtual software switches, connects to each other virtual switch using a tunnel. And they have a controller, which then programs all of those. The unique thing about this solution is that each of those software routers are routers. They are MPLS routers. So they actually have the capability.
Or VXLAN or NVGRE.
MPLS over GPRE. So what they'll do is if they're talking between two access, two V routers, two Contrail V routers, they use VXLAN because VXLAN is protocol load balances nicely over ECMP or MLAG links. Whereas if you've got a flow coming, so if you can imagine the traffic comes out of the VM and hits the virtual router, the Contrail virtual router, it then makes a decision. Do I need to layer 2 switch that? Do I need to layer 3 route that back to the VM next to me? Or do I need to layer 3 route that into a VXLAN tunnel to VRouter 2966 over there and then inject it into a VXLAN frame so it wanders off over the LAN to that switch?
The point being that virtual router can do all of that right there in software.
That's
They're not relying on a piece of hardware upstream to accomplish any of those things.
No, and because it's distributed in every Intel server, it scales quite nicely.
Mm.
Now, the second thing that it does is if you've actually got to talk off the WAN, maybe to a second data center or you're talking away, it doesn't just pop that into a VLAN and let it, you know, create an external organizational, and then pop it into a base VLAN, puts it into an MPLS over GRE tunnel and sends it up to the PE because a normal PE router can speak MPLS over GRE. That's a standard feature. Now, all of those tunnels, all of that virtual router configuration is all done in a controller that we saw a demo of today. This is probably the future of SDN. What I'm seeing is if you've done any looking into what Nasir has done up until now, that's what they've been doing. Nasir has been doing a layer 2 switch at the edge based on Open vSwitch. They're using STT as a protocol to connect the layer 2 vSwitches in the data center. But only in the data center. What Contrail's doing is bumping this up with the MPLS over GRE to get to the WAN edge where your MPLS router is, so it's secured in there. You're using routing in the edge, whereas Nasira was just doing switching in the OVS. And they are also scaling horizontally. So you can have multiple controllers in the data center, and they'll use BGP protocol to talk between the controllers. And they'll also use a BGP over your existing MPLS backbone to signal configuration data between data centers. So you can have a controller in data center A and a controller in data center B, and they'll use a BGP to your PEs to exchange data between them.
So you can scale that forever and ever, effectively. There's your... to a point, but yeah.
Well,
know what I'm saying.
Was another scaling factor, which I thought I heard, that, we're just going to do routing as the fabric that this runs on top of. So, and the point that was tied to the point of robustness. Now, for some reason, I came away from that talk with this craving for a plate of spaghetti.
Tunnels, right. And, Greg, I think you turned it a tunnel fabric. That's effectively what you got. Now, you got two V-routers that need to talk two different layer 3 endpoints or two different IP addresses that are in two different layer 3 segments, and the V-router can do the header rewrite to do the routing right there and nail up a tunnel right in between the two of them without having to go upstream to another device to get the routing done. So again, Pete, to your point, you end up with tunnels forming all over the place potentially, so that all these different endpoints can talk to each other.
It's a little scary up front. How do I troubleshoot this? But on the other hand, it's sort of freeing. I'm a big fan of layer 3 over layer 2 rather than layer 2 in terms of stability. So that part resonated for me.
Yeah.
So the definitely the MPLS integration into the existing edge to drain out of the SDN island that you're creating in the data center, I think that makes a nice clean break there, because now you just, you know, feed that right along in the path into your PE edge. My concern would be having the proper elements in the hypervisor to support this, because they're not using Open vSwitch. This is a new forwarding signaling protocol that's going to have vSwitches for it. So you're either going to be running, you know, you're going to have to run some kind of shim in there to participate in this. So
the positives that I saw was they're using open standards for just about everything. So VXLAN internally, MPLS over GRE to the WAN edge, BGP to do the sideways, to do the east-west controller integration, XMPP coming down from the controller to the V-router. The V-router is custom code. They've chosen to do that because they see it as being their value, which means today it's only for Linux or for a bare metal deployment, which means Linux on bare metal. So KVM, where does this leave them with Microsoft and VMware? It's hard to know.
Well, and you hit it really well at the beginning, though, because this is – so SDN, early SDN, and possibly forever SDN is starting at the edge. So the problem is at the edge. It's classification at the edge. It's getting into the proper something into the backbone. If you're looking to make layer 4 decisions in the middle of your network in the core, you probably should have – you missed something on the edge, because some of the scale factors go away as you distribute that out around the edge.
That's right.
So when we start talking about flow rules and things like that, you know, that's not something necessarily to be scared of, because if you're doing that distributed at the edge and have centralized topology somewhere, you know, I think the big question is going to be, do we find a fairly simple mechanism to instantiate forwarding, or do we try and use an existing mechanism and everything that comes with that?
That's right. Because if you're saying there's a switch in every server, if you're saying there's a switch in every physical server or router in every physical server, we've got an administration problem, because everything we do in networking today is CLI based, right? And so there's no way we could use our legacy methodologies of touching the CLI on every switch or touching the CLI on every router if there's one in every server. If your data center's got 300 servers, you've just got 300 edge routers.
Right, and I'm wondering what's the role of OpenFlow? Because some vendors would have it be the infrastructure that you run over. And in this model where you have a layer 3 infrastructure, the OpenFlow is really your mechanism for programming the packet and frame mutations that happen in the edge device, mm-hmm. yeah. rather than the firewalling and load balancing and all the stuff.
Which is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
It's the same. OpenFlow is an API. It's not a configuration, mm-hmm. right? Unlike conf.t. where you're actually configuring the box through the parser, OpenFlow is saying this is my intention.
Although as I'm visualizing it right now, instead of having a bunch of interconnected OpenFlow devices, you're almost running isolated instances that are segregated at layer 3 by the virtual router. One other possibility that I'm thinking about in this context, and maybe I can't tie this back in verbally, was after reading about Cisco's 1000V InterCloud, they announced that they would support all of the hypervisors, that you didn't need to be running even a 1000V instance in the cloud, because their mechanism was to put a VM in the cloud and tie it using whatever your vSwitch mechanism mm-hmm. was to the VMs that you were plumbing into this thing.
All right. Well, I think the interesting thing about the Contrail solution, of course, is that it doesn't need you to change your data center switching strategy. So the flip side is that because everything external to the vRouter, which is actually in the server, it doesn't matter what your current data center LAN is. So you can start deploying this in your data center today.
It's an underlay network.
Yeah, that can underlay is
whatever you want to encapsulate.
You don't need
right
to go out
top.
And buy Juniper EX switches or Juniper, you know, QFabric to run this. I've got no doubt that it would probably run better, you know, from Contrail's point of view, because they've been acquired by Juniper.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't start deploying this in your data center today if you chose to use this as your switching strategy, your, you know, virtual switch routing strategy in your hypervisors.
The one thing I didn't get coming out of the Contrail presentation was, why is it going to take so long to bring this product to market? Because when the announcement was made, they're talking about calendar year 2014. Mm. So I was a little puzzled by that, because they showed us working and running technology, and I'm not sure if any of you guys have insight into what the delay is all about.
If I remember correctly, they hit the play button, which is smart, because anybody doing an OpenStack demo only does it once, because it
typically you're right. So the demo that they showed us was a recording of a screencast. It actually, in fact, was not a live demo, and that's kind of underscores the point that perhaps this is not fully baked yet.
And, I mean, building a control plane is not an easy thing.
Yeah.
There was BGP in one of those slides, and I kind of zoned out at that point, or maybe they didn't say what exactly that was doing there.
You know, it's hard not to think of it as niche carrier before VMware gets into the carrier market, but they're definitely going after enterprise. So enterprises are absolutely looking at keep your gold services on, your ERPs, your SAPs, you know, whatever it is that has to be there, keep it on VMware, because you know, everybody understands it, and then start looking at open source. What I took away from Juniper today was they're trying to define where, and I think they did a pretty good job defining where they are in the open source ecosystem.
Yeah.
I think the BGP piece was to interconnect islands of Contrail domains. Is what I thought it was. It was Route Exchange.
Yeah. East-West controller connectivity.
Yeah, yes.
So you can have more than one. So you can scale your controllers by having multiple controllers in a single data center. You have multiple data centers, and the controllers will communicate with each other.
That's what he was talking about in that slide. I just never heard that tied specifically to the BGP, which may have been me.
Well, see, your controllers have to communicate somehow.
Yeah.
So what they're saying is, rather than building another communication path, just use the routing control plane that already exists in your MPLS backbone.
Well, whenever I am in a Juniper presentation, I expect to hear BGP, and I expect to hear MPLS at some point during the presentation.
Yeah.
So I felt gratified.
Yeah. You think?
Expectations,
yes.
a little predictable there. A little bit of predictable. Mm-hmm.
We have a hammer called BGP, and we have a wrench called MPLS. And
that's right.
We can fix everything with them.
Okay, so very quickly touching on, we had a Mykonos demo again. What's it now called? Web App Secure. They bought a security tool, gave us another demo of that. I think we've talked about that previously and got all flushed and hot and bothered about it.
Well, right. It's a security tool it's not a web application firewall. It's not an IPS engine. Instead, Web App Secure.
Defense.
Yeah, it actively tries to trap hackers, people that are messing around with your site, trying to poke holes at you and figure out what's going on. Well, they're looking for the poking of holes. They're not looking for a known exploit. They're looking for the behavior that leads up to a known exploit. So what they do is they'll take a page that got served up by a web server and that's heading back to the client, inject a bunch of odds and ends in there. And then as they see responses come back, they can tell, oh, this got messed with, that got messed with, and the other thing got messed with. And so I know this isn't part of the application because I injected it. So therefore, I can make a determination that this is probably a hacker or some sort of a malicious attempt to do something. And then it can react. It can react by slowing down further communications to that client. It could react by throwing up a capture screen and forcing you to acknowledge the capture before it allow you to go on, or just block you out. And you can build policies around that. You know, and then in addition, you got a very extensive audit trail of what everything that was going on between client and service. You had a full fingerprint, if you will, of everything that was going on for that entire session. I don't know if it was 100% what you call forensic, but certainly it led you down that road.
So apropos of fingerprinting, they mentioned that they looked at 200 characteristics of the browser agent and so on, and that if you allowed the centralized reporting of potential suspects, they could correlate this across different companies that might be under attack. So that was kind of interesting.
Right, there was a phone home functionality there with the data you were seeing to go to the mothership of signatures. Fingerprints. Yeah,
check with the FBI fingerprint repository, so to speak. And so you could correlate across different companies being under attack, maybe share other commonalities. So the tar pits was the other thing, I think, was the term.
Yeah, that's the term that was used. That's what I was alluding to when they were injecting code into a page being served up to a client. They call that a tar pit. Yeah.
So they seem to be shaping the responses from the web server to just slow it down so that the hacker would be waiting until...
Economic cost.
Yeah.
The economic cost of attacking a site becomes unfeasible because they keep giving bad responses or indirection, misdirection, obfuscation. Mm-hmm. But they don't attack the attacker. They don't go offensive.
But they did have the false leads where they led them down the honey trail, so to speak.
That's right, then hopefully by then they'd have given up and gone somewhere else because it wasn't making any sense.
It'd be the economic allegory was the one that kept coming up. We want to make it so expensive in hacker terms to attack this site that they're just going to go away. They're not going to bother anymore. And it wasn't that Mykonos or Web App Secure, I guess they're calling it, was replacing an IPS. They really went all out with that name. Yeah, Web App Secure.
That's just genius marketing.
Right? That's a late in the day around the table. Yeah. What? Just call it Web App Secure. I don't freaking care anymore. Can we move on?
Best story I ever heard. There used to be a reseller, I think it was based out of the UK, and it was called Anite. A-N-I-T-E. And I said to the guy, well, how come it's called Anite? That's a bit of an odd name. He said, well, we'd spent 2 days arguing over what it would be. And the guy just stood up and said, damn it, I'm just going to call it Anite. And they went, perfect, Anite.
I found myself thinking that they'd missed one bet with that technology because they were evaluating the potential attacks as low, medium, or experienced, sophisticated. And maybe they should have issued diplomas. Congratulations. You've made it to the level of medium level attacker.
Gamified. Give it a game. Give it a score.
Like, you loser. Go away. Yeah. Don't bother attacking.
Please enter your email address and we'll email you your attack score. Yeah. There you go. You don't need to do pen testing. Just give us get them to see if they can get a high score on the game.
Well, they could tie it to the power over Ethernet technology, or get PCs built with the remote shock technology. You loser.
So probably the one thing that stood out to me is the information analytics. I think that was pretty unique. Overall, most of the time when I'm getting a security briefing on a product, they're so atrocious that I'm ready to jump out the window, and I didn't even get up towards the window. So overall, it was pretty decent.
And actually for a security demo, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
Because normally in a security presentation, all it is fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and you need this because you don't know if you're secure or not. We don't actually know if it works, but we think we can make money out of stealing money from you. Yeah. For something that we don't know if it actually works ourselves, which is pretty interesting. So I think the integration too, if Web App Secure can do some SRX integration in the future. And SRX is already doing integration with its virtual SRX platform with the VSG, their virtual hypervisor security strategy. So there's already existing APIs in the SRX to do dynamic path changing dynamic programming of the firewall under certain conditions.
Shunning.
Yeah, I called it shunning, but that's not the right word for it. So, Stephen, is there anything about the event this week? I know you're not, you are more of a storage / virtualization guy, but was there any highlights this week that lit up your magic wand?
That made my day?
Yeah.
Well, on a meta level, it was really good to see active discussion and back and forth across the table. You know, I'm always, always disappointed with Tech Field Day when the delegates file in and they sit down at the table for a presentation with a vendor and don't really say much and then file back out. That doesn't happen too often, but it does happen sometimes, usually when the presenter just doesn't connect with the delegates. I always tell the companies that, frankly, the thing that makes a great presentation is not the technology being presented or the location or the time slot. It's all about the presenter. That didn't happen here.
Mm.
It was really, really nice to see you guys actively engaging with the companies. And the cool thing was that the vendors really appreciated it as well. So even the more controversial topics and free-form discussions, as it were, those were actually really appreciated. And
Abner at Juniper actually made that point specifically. Yeah. He said, we really need this conversation and the dialogue because it helps us understand what you're facing and what you're thinking about.
It's awesome.
And because we're not customers. We're not buying.
Yeah.
That's the big trick, is that we're still interested in their technology. We're interested in the companies, but we're not like somebody who's sitting there with a $50 million budget trying to decide whether to buy company A, B, or C. We just really want to talk about the technology for its own sake.
Yeah.
Well, I think it gives them a chance to work their story out. So if they're presenting something and it comes across a little screwy, they find the landmines before they do it and have the landmines sort of blow up in their face.
So how was your experience of the event?
I enjoyed it. A lot of intellectual stimulus. I think I'm going to sleep very soundly tonight after all this mental exercise. I feel my brain's bulging, you know, new muscles up there.
Hasn't happened for me yet. Must keep working on it.
Lobotomized.
Is there anything else there, Stephen?
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the things that came to me after seeing the Juniper Secure Web App demo, I really want to see an as-a-service version of that because I would love to put that in front of my website. I would love to see how many people are trying to mess with my website, and I would really love to mess with them right back. I think that's my favorite thing about that product is the kind of, you know, screw with the people who are trying to screw with you aspect of it. I just love that. And, I mean, obviously, I'm never going to go buy one of those for my website. I mean, maybe, I don't know, someday, you know, when Packet Pushers is huge and you guys are the next CNN, you could buy one, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it, but wouldn't it be awesome to have an as a service thing?
Would be cool. Well, Stephen, I'm curious about your take on the confluence of network virtualization with storage and just compute virtualization in general, because that was the big emphasis here this week.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. One of the things that I say in my seminars is that you can learn a lot about a vendor's strategy by just considering where their focus is. You know, VMware is hypervisor-centric. Everything is ruled by the hypervisor, no matter what they come out with. And of course, VMware is not selling the hypervisor. They give the hypervisor away for free, but they are centered on the hypervisor and everything they do. You know, look at what they're doing with Nicira. They're going to have the hypervisor rule the network, right? They're going to have, you know, software-defined networking, software-defined data center. To VMware means the hypervisor defines it.
Software-defined storage.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at
software-defined.
Yeah.
Software-defined.
Software-defined Faro.
Yeah. It's software-defined all the way down.
But if you look at Microsoft, it's all centered on the OS. Again, Microsoft makes more money probably on apps, and I mean, they've got cloud services and everything, but everything is about the OS. If you look at Cisco, where's the center? I mean, the intelligence lives in the switch. The intelligence lives in the network. And that's funny with a lot of these networking companies. You know, you look at what they're doing. They're all about trying to bring more functionality out of the other layers of the stack and into the network, more control, maybe not functionality, but more control. And so it's interesting to see these convergence with storage and networks From Cisco's perspective, convergence means getting all that pesky storage stuff onto our real manly network.
Yep.
From Brocade's perspective, it often means, you know, bringing more of that networking stuff to what we've already been able to do with Fibre Channel all these years. You know, obviously Brocade has moved beyond Fibre Channel. And when you all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But I think that Brocade fabric technology is very amusing if from that perspective.
Yeah, it makes sense. They've had the fabric for longer than anybody else.
Absolutely. It just wasn't an Ethernet fabric.
No,
so.
it was a serial cable one using fiber channel. It was a tunnel. It was literally a tunnel fabric. Fiber channel is about creating tunnels from end to end.
So this almost sounds, what you're describing almost sounds like the story of the seven blind men and the elephant.
Absolutely.
This feels like a switch to me.
This feels like a hypervisor to me.
and think about Plexi. What does it feel like to them?
But the overall message is software control. So this, and this is, comes back to what Brocade was talking about with David Meyer saying, if we get into a world where software can configure everything, that means we're actually now talking about if everybody can configure every feature every which way and we can do it faster than we can ever configure something before, we can fail faster than we can fix it. And that is the challenge going forward into a software-defined future, is how do we get reliability and robustness back into our networks, even though we're going to make changes consistently over and over. You know, it's just going to be
How can we fix faster than we can fail?
Yeah. Or how do we fail so it doesn't matter?
Yeah. And that's actually, let me tell you guys, just to give you a little non sequitur that goes right to this. One of the coolest innovations in storage, one of the most innovative things that I've seen lately is this Ceph storage array, open source cloud storage system. And the coolest aspect of it is that it wasn't designed to repair faults all the time. It was designed to just assume things were broken all the time and continue to run. And so it is really where David was talking about, in that you build your system not to live in a perfect world, but to live in an absolutely imperfect world. And commoditization of technology, I mean, the networking industry is going to have to live with this as well. You know, I mean, Cisco, you know, everybody else is using, you know, commodity parts now, commodity hardware. If that stuff has failures, then they have to design their system to deal with that failure, not to pretend it doesn't exist.
That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure that you come back. Remember that you can join a deeper discussion at our forum at packetpushers.net. And, of course, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, because you can email us at packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on today's show, or follow us on the Twitter at packetpushers. I'd like to thank our external resources joining us this week. Peter, tell us a little bit about where people can find you and what you'll be doing in the week ahead.
Well, the easiest way to find me is my blog at the netcraftsman.net site, or pjwelcher@gmail.com. Not my corporate address, but easier to spell on the radio or podcast.
Cool. And Brent, what's up with you, buddy?
You know, I just want to real quick thank the vendors for sponsoring us, for coming out. I know they realize that our passion isn't to give them make their lives hard. It's because we care about the industry. And I especially want to thank you guys, Ethan, Greg, and Steven, for all you all do for putting together community. You know, it's given not just me, but hundreds, and, you know, just everybody out there, pay it forward, whatever you get out of this. And it really teaches people we're starting to develop a little bit of community in the networking industry, and it's pretty exciting. And you guys were the catalyst, in my opinion. This week, going to get back to the real world of drawing pictures for a living.
I know that feeling. So people can find you on your blog at?
I blog at networkstatic.net, and I'm on Twitter at networkstatic.
Go read Brent's blog. Seriously, it's great, great, great stuff. Look, Brent's in the process of evaluating and implementing OpenFlow in his network, and has a lot of unique challenges that he deals with that, and he blogs about it. Great stuff, worth reading.
Yeah, we had a lot of, oh, you're Brent moments this week.
Yeah.
Mr. Foskett, what about you?
All right. Well, I'm easy to find at sfoskett on Twitter, and blog.foskett.net. And, you know, I write about anything that I care to write about. I'm also actually easy to find. I've been traveling the world and the country doing seminars and server virtualization. I'll be in the next few weeks. I'm going to be in Minneapolis, New York City, Seattle, and San Francisco in doing different public speaking engagements. And actually, next week is another Tech Field Day event, if you can believe it.
So that's a multi-vendor one, isn't it? That's
Next week is the Aruba Airheads Conference, so it's a single-vendor one.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Cool. Mr. Banks?
Well, my real world involves getting a set of 6500s retired and moving them over to FEX and finishing off some presentations that I'll be doing. I'll be presenting at Modern Infrastructure in New York City in April. That is a Tech Target event. I'll be talking about SDN. I'm calling it Practical SDN, which what that presentation is really going to amount to is kind of a industry overview. This is what SDN really is, and this is where all the players are and what they're doing. And then also working on a presentation for Interop in May. And I'll be blogging at packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at EC Banks.
And I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com, and on the Twitter is at etherealmind. I've got a bunch of white papers to write. We've been commissioned to do some white papers for various people. And I'll also be at the London VMUG on April the 24th, I believe, where I'll be telling virtualization engineers what a cloud network looks like instead of a virtual network, because virtual networks are yesterday's technology. So I'm looking forward to that. Plus, you can all buy me beers after the event. Thank you very much. So, as always... don't forget to hit the show blog post to leave comments on today's show. Join us in the forum. Follow us on Twitter. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.